It may be hard to believe, but actor and comedian Dick Van Dyke marked his 100th birthday last year on December 13th. PBS took the occasion to celebrate that milestone with a special edition of the American Masters series titled Starring Dick Van Dyke. Melanie McFarlane, senior critic for Salon, took a few moments to reflect with us on the impact of this creative genius, and she's done so by developing a kind of thought experiment, posing a what-if question. She begins with this setup. For a moment, imagine a world in which the Dick Van Dyke Show only existed for one season. How would popular culture be different? And she doesn't even wait for us to answer. She chimes in, first of all, the version of Mary Poppins that babysat millions of us wouldn't exist. The film's producers certainly would have found someone else to play Bert the Chimney Sweep. But would his performance match Van Dyke's soaring merriment and nimble footwork, those grace notes cementing the film's status as an intergenerational classic? Doubtful. Without the Dick Van Dyke Show, Sheldon Cooper and Leonard Hofstadter of The Big Bang Theory would have different monikers, since they were named after Van Dyke's executive producer, Sheldon Leonard. Paul Reiser might not have been inspired to make Mad About You, and neither Conan O'Brien nor Jim Carrey would have deployed their rubbery physical comedy as impressively as they do. We would also lose one of TV's most unforgettable opening sequences, highlighted by Van Dyke's Rob Petrie tumbling over an ottoman, then springing to his feet with a grin. That famous title scene began appearing in the second season, whereas the first merely displayed the cast's photos. As soon as I saw Dick Van Dyke tripping over the ottoman and getting up with a smile on his face, I was hooked, because I felt like that's what Dick is here to say. Jim Carrey observes in the PBS American Masters feature, it's not a pratfall, it's a metaphor. If you tumble, you've got to pop right up and laugh at yourself, because you are ridiculous. We're all ridiculous, and life is an absurd obstacle course of unforeseen ottomans. McFarlane continues, Van Dyke turned 100 on Saturday, December 13th, 2025, and he'd already marked the occasion with the November release of his sixth book and his second one on longevity, titled 100 Rules for Living to 100, An Optimist's Guide to a Happy Life. The actor himself is inspirationally durable, so is the Dick Van Dyke Show, which ran between 1961 and 1966, but has graced our televisions ever since, whether in syndication or by video on demand. The late Carl Reiner, who created the series and based Van Dyke's TV writer on himself, called his star the single most talented man in situation comedy. But, as starring Dick Van Dyke establishes, the agile song and dance man with a perpetual twinkle in his eye is much more than that. He's one of modern television's foundational influences. The two-hour documentary includes interviews with Jim Carrey and Conan O'Brien, as well as Only Murders in the Building stars Steve Martin and Martin Short, a duo deeply influenced by Van Dyke's blend of eloquence and acrobatics. For ardent fans and casual appreciators alike, the PBS program starring Dick Van Dyke is a must-see. It's still available on demand. However, it doesn't fully investigate the Dick Van Dyke Show's lasting impact. In fairness, the American Masters installment is a tribute, not a turnpaper, and it's a splendid homage at that, but understanding how the show's deft, crisp writing and Van Dyke's incomparable chemistry with his co-star Mary Tyler Moore serve as a blueprint for the modern family sitcom, and that requires going back to the source. Fortunately, The Dick Van Dyke Show is always available to watch somewhere, because it's one of the rare mid-century comedies that still holds up more than six decades later. If you doubt that, check out some of the show's contemporaries, including other Sheldon Leonard productions like The Andy Griffith Show and The Danny Thomas Show. It doesn't take much to notice how distinct Van Dyke's Rob Petrie is from other post-war TV dads. Simply put, Rob Petrie is a great guy. He balances his career as a TV writer with being a devoted husband to Moore's Laura Petrie and a caring, involved parent to their son Richie. But Rob was more than just a good father. Van Dyke and Mary Tyler Moore's portrayal of Rob and Laura as an overtly loving couple was revolutionary in its time. In an archival interview featured in Starring Dick Van Dyke, Carl Reiner says he envisioned Rob and Laura's marriage as two against the world versus two against each other. That matters because, unlike other half-hours that cast famous performers as family men while leaving their TV wives nothing to do, the Dick Van Dyke Show placed Rob and Laura on equal footing and made Mary Tyler Moore a star in her own right. Whether directly or in a roundabout way, it all circles back to the Dick Van Dyke Show, which was nearly a single-season wonder. It's true that the speculative scenario launching all this almost did not become a reality. At the end of its freshman run, the Dick Van Dyke Show ranked 80th out of 117 broadcast shows in the ratings. Its sponsor, Procter & Gamble, withdrew its support, and CBS canceled it. Had Leonard, its executive producer, failed to persuade Procter & Gamble to resume its sponsorship, the show that raised multiple generations of TV writers, performers, and smitten hams might have been lost to the static of history. As Martin Short says in Starring Dick Van Dyke, being in a hit TV show is a fluke. There's no guarantees. It's just when the stars lined up, he said. That's why I wish he'd done the show longer. And then Melanie concludes, we'll have to settle for 5 close-to-perfect seasons we can appreciate forever, whether in one form or many others. That from an essay by Melanie McFarland in Salon, marking the 100th birthday of Dick Van Dyke this past December. And we need to pay attention to her final sentence there. We'll have to settle for 5 close-to-perfect seasons we can appreciate forever. Those 5 close-to-perfect seasons that we can appreciate forever, whether in one form or many others, she says, whether in one form or many others. And that is a key for us. To our surprise, one of those other forms is opera, and we'll get the full story soon. But first we learn about Carl Reiner and his lifelong desire to be an opera singer. He says he fell in love with the form from listening to his father's records featuring Enrico Caruso. NYS Music delights us with the story that Reiner was 33 years old when he joined the TV show Caesar's Hour in 1955. Sid Caesar took the lead role in their send-up of the opera I Pagliacci by Leoncavallo. Reiner played Emilio, or Silvio, in the original. That amazing archival video still exists, and it is juxtaposed with the 91-year-old Reiner as a guest on the show Conan with host Conan O'Brien, where Reiner actually sings Vesti la Giubba. So we can only imagine the sheer delight when Carl Reiner received a call out of the blue from Paul Salerni, award-winning composer, asking for permission to set an episode of The Dick Van Dyke Show as a one-act opera, like Pagliacci. Carl Reiner gave Paul Salerni his blessing, and we are hearing a recent recording of the life and love of Joe Coogan. Dr. Salerni has just retired from his position as the NEH Distinguished Chair in the Humanities and Professor of Music at Lehigh University in Bethlehem. He is a great friend of WVIA, having composed Palma, a musical fable, to mark the 50th anniversary of WVIA Radio and the Northeastern Pennsylvania Philharmonic. Dr. Salerni was pleased to pay a visit to the WVIA studios to share the new recording with us and tell the tale.
I had written a one-act opera with Dana Gioia called Tony Cruz's Final Broadcast. And, you know, one-act operas are usually paired with another one-act opera. Maybe the most famous combination is Cavalleria Rusticana and I Pagliacci, Kevin Pagg. That's a standard evening of two one-act operas. Then there's also three one-act operas, Tritico by Puccini, but often done with just two. So I said, I needed something that was relatively funny, relatively light. And Laura and I, for a long time, have been great fans of the Dick Van Dyke Show. We own the whole DVD set. You know, for much of our lives, we didn't go to bed without watching an episode. So we know them all almost by heart. And then one night, we saw The Life and Love of Joe Coogan, and she just turned to me. She said, "There it is. There's your one act." I said, "What? A Dick Van Dyke TV show?" Said, "Yeah, it's got everything." And ironically, it had all these connections to Tony Cruzo, because there's an apartment peace role. There's a spiritual choice that the main character has to make. There were lots of voice types in common. And I said, "Wow, aren't you smart, Laura Johnson?" And then the challenge became, how do you get permission? And so I knew that Carl Reiner, who had created the show, had also written the script for this particular episode. So I had to figure out how to get to either Mr. Reiner or his agent. And I called CBS, and they said, "Okay, here's his agent, Ruth Engelhart." And I called Ruth Engelhart, and I said, "I want permission from Mr. Reiner to use the script to adapt it to become an opera." And she said, "That's very interesting. I'll call Mr. Reiner, see what he says." And she called me back and she said, "Mr. Reiner would like to talk to you, but I need to warn you, Mr. Reiner is the nicest man in the entire world." And so I did talk to him for 45 minutes on the phone, and I was so excited. I was jumping out of my skin. And, you know, he said he was just thrilled that I was going to do this. He had one requirement. He said, and he actually has written short stories about this, and actually wanted to be an opera singer, except for he can't carry a tune, was what he said. He said, "I want to make sure that the tenor has a high C at some point in the opera." And I did that for him, and it turned out well. And maybe one of the most entertaining afternoons Laura and I have ever had in our lives was when Tony Cruzo was done in Los Angeles. Mr. Reiner came incognito with his family, with his daughter Annie and his son Lucas. And then at the end of the opera, he said, "Well, have you written anything on our opera?" And I said, "Yeah, I have something." He said, "Well, can you come over to the house and play it for me?" So Laura and I spent an afternoon at Carl Reiner's house in Beverly Hills, and it was magical. I mean, I sat in the chair where normally Mel Brooks sat every night. You know, unfortunately, Mr. Reiner's no longer with us.
Did you have interchange as you took it forward then with him, or he waited till you did what you were going to do and then commented?
The only interchange we had was at his house, and he was very happy with what I had done so far, and he really wanted to come to the premiere, but by then he was in his 90s, and he said, "I can't come, but I'm going to send a little extra money to you so that you can make a good video." So we did make a good video. We sent it to Mr. Reiner. Mr. Reiner gathered up his family and Mr. Van Dyke, and they sat in his living room and they watched it. And he wrote back to me. He said, "I loved everything except for the beginning. The beginning was terrible." Buddy Sorrell and Mel Cooley would never interact and touch each other the way that it looks there. And there was no necessity to explain their relationship, because in my script, and I said every word of his script, besides other things that the librettist Kate Light wrote, every word of that script is in this particular opera, his words. Most of the musical lines, some spoken as dialogue. But he said, "There's no necessity for this." And of course, comic genius that he was right. And so I did fix it. Unfortunately, I didn't get a recording of it before he died. So he doesn't know that I fixed it, but I fixed it. So what you would hear on the recording is the revised version that I think Mr. Reiner would have approved of.
Are we imagining it, or do we hear echoes of a certain theme of the show?
Well, I mean, aren't you astute, Miss Erica Funky? Yes. In fact, the key to this entire thing is that every note in the music that I wrote is in some ways motivically derived from and I have to, I don't know if it was luck or just her brilliance, but my librettist, Kate Light, who was a wonderful poet, but also a violinist in the New York City Opera Orchestra for years and years and years, the plot revolves around a sonnet that the main character, Joe Coogan, has written for his then love of his life, now married to Rob Petrie, Laura Petrie. And there's a moment in that sonnet where the poet says, here, there, and everywhere. And it's actually speaking about God. But it's a meta comment, because when those words happen in the opera, in the last duet of the opera, it's exactly when the first time an audience who knows the Dick Van Dyke TV show would realize that it's there, because it's actually quoted. And it's actually here and there and everywhere in the opera. So, you know, it's my little inside joke, but also my inspiration for making this a coherent piece of art, that, you know, one of the requirements of Western music is that there be a single idea that permeates a piece of art, and that's it.
You were talking about Maria Graver and her ability to write a good pop tune and so forth, but talk to us about writing Laura. That's just such a charmer.
Yeah, thank you. I think it's a charmer and it's a pop tune. But again, it was the requirement. I don't want to be self-congratulatory, but the clever part is that the harmonic underpinning of that comes directly from the Dick Van Dyke TV show episode Harmonies. But in the midst of this kind of soft shoe that Rob Petrie sings, because he's singing about his beloved wife, adorable Laura, the other character, priest named Joe Coogan, sings part of the sonnet that he wrote, and they all go together. And, you know, the wonderful thing about opera that other genres can't do is you can have two people speaking at the same time where you can understand both of them because of the magic of music. So that, for me, that's a magical moment when they actually sing together. He's singing about Laura in a very classical style, very operatic style, accompanied by string quartet. Rob Petrie is singing a soft shoe number accompanied by a jazz band in a totally different style, but it goes together.
What did your Laura say when she heard that?
You know, Laura's a pro. And so all Laura was worried about how she was going to stage it. Okay, yeah, so I can see how I'm going to do this now. And she does her job. And so I think she absolutely distanced herself from the fact that this was her husband writing this, that it was somewhat about her. She just needed to do her job, which is to make sure it was effective on stage.
Tell us about the production then, how this was recorded.
This was recorded, there had been a couple performances fully staged of this opera, one that we did, one that was done at Otterbein University with all undergraduates' kids. It was absolutely terrific. And when we got to the point of me revising it, I really couldn't afford to do a fully staged version. So we did a concert version with the people who were on the CD. And after we did the concert version, we recorded it. They're terrific singers.
You've worked with them before, haven't you?
Yeah. In fact, lots of them appear on Tony Caruso. And again, if in my ideal world, someday these two would be staged together and the people singing here would be singing. So for instance, the person singing the main character of Laura Petrie is Dizela Lauer Stotir, great Icelandic soprano, sings at the Met, but she was the nun on the recording of Tony Caruso. The main character is sung by Keith Ferris. Keith Ferris was the priest on Tony Caruso. Yeah, so there'd be a lot of roles that you could do one role in Tony Caruso and then do a different role in Joe Coogan.
What is the state of the art when it comes to producing opera like this in the country today? We know the Met is laying off people left and right and that sort of thing. Where would this wind up? Regional opera?
It would probably wind up. It was designed really so that it could be done in training programs, so that in conservatories, or even like at Otterbein. Otterbein is a liberal arts institution. It was done by undergraduates because they could sing it. Even Tony Caruso, which is really actually requires professional, was done not with full orchestra, but with just piano at Lincoln University, which of course is historically black college and all undergraduates. So both of them can be done in this context. Obviously did both of them at Lehigh. Some professional singers, but some student singers.
Where do we find it? How do we hear it?
Actually, just go on all of the usual streaming platforms, you know, Spotify, Apple Music. It's all there. I mean, there's a limited number of physical CDs for us old people who only listen to physical CDs. The only way you can get them is either contact Satsuma Collective or contact me, and I'd be happy to send them out.
Do you have to wait for Laura to poke you in the ribs and say, there, Paul, that needs to be an opera? Are you working on anything now?
Oh, I'm actually working on something right now. Again, whether it comes to fruition or not, we'll see. So I have long been fascinated by a story that was kind of brought to light by a Lehigh alumnus, Joe Perella. He kind of funded and produced a movie about how a certain segment of the population of Italy protected Jews during World War II when the Nazis were taking people off to concentration camps. And the central character is a very famous bicyclist, Gino Bartali, who, you know, won the Tour de France twice and was very anti-fascist and went around as if he were training, going on long rides. But what he was doing was transporting fake passports for Jews to get out of Italy. But there were lots of various things. Some cardinals in the church and some people in the church were very good about protecting and trying to save them. And so I have a librettist working on it. We've been through the first three scenes of the first act. So we'll see. Again, as you said, the idea that opera getting produced is difficult is obviously in our minds all the time. And so we'll do our best.
Award-winning composer Paul Salerni, recently retired from his position as the NEH Distinguished Chair in the Humanities and Professor of Music at Lehigh University in Bethlehem, speaking with us about the recent release of this recording, a recording of his one-act opera, The Life and Love of Joe Coogan, and that has as its source an episode of The Dick Van Dyke Show with the screenplay by Carl Reiner, who developed the show, that show, and libretto by Kate Light. We heard the story of how Dr. Salerni was able to contact Carl Reiner and get his blessing and then deliver a work like this. This is the final duet, which is titled There and Everywhere, and Paul just told us that the real subject of this is God.
That's beautiful, honey.
Yes, it's beautiful, and I feel so silly. I like an idiot, thought he meant me.
Well, who did he mean? Music
from the one-act opera, The Life and Love of Joe Coogan by Paul Salerni. And it's available on the platforms Dr. Salerni mentioned to us. And you can always check Dr. Salerni's website. And it's simply hisname.com. So it's paulsalerni.com. Paul, SALERNI.com. And you can find more about the life and love of Joe Coogan. You can hear more of Dr. Salerni's music and his distinguished life and career.